Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Monday, this hour of the show, How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends. Mark Durr is our guest, and Mark has written several books about dogs. He is the author, actually, of A Dog's History of America and Dog's Best Friend. He has written for the New York Times, LA Times, Audubon, Sierra, Natural History, the Smithsonian, Scientific American, and the Atlantic Monthly. And this book came about because he said a couple years ago a young editor tracked him through cyberspace and asked him if he would consider writing about how the wolf became the dog. He welcomed the chance, he says, to examine what was known and suspected against what was possible in the world at the time of the various periods in question. So he has been delving into this topic, and some of it, you know, of course, goes way, way back. So it's an interesting examination of all kinds of things, of, you know, archaeological records and of anthropology, paleontology, psychology, and sociology, biology, genetics, physiology, and anatomy all figure into this examination of how the dog became the dog. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Mark. Our phone number, have I said what his name is? Mark Durr is our guest. I'm not sure I said that. Mark Durr is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. He joins us from a studio in Miami where he lives with his wife and dog. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I should correct. There's no dog currently. The last one standing passed away in September.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. What kind of dog? Tell me about that dog.
That dog was Katie, known as the Kate. She was an Australian Kelpie, a gift from a rancher friend in Texas 13 and a half years ago.
Oh.
She was his pick of the litter, and he thought she would be a little short in the wheelbase to handle cattle. She might have been, but she had a great deal of desire. We called her Two Brain because she was a genius among dogs.
How was she a genius? How did that manifest itself?
Well, she taught herself to, she learned to fetch the tennis ball in about 10 minutes when she was 9 weeks old. She learned very quickly that if she wanted it thrown, she had to bring it back. And the rest of her life she spent, let's say she learned everything on one or two takes, and then it became boring to her. So although she was very intelligent, she was difficult sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I have a self-coated Wheaton Terrier because there have been allergies in our house, and our dog is difficult. He's really smart, but he can be really stubborn, just like everybody else in the house. So I guess we all get
exactly.
along. Yes, we all get along,
it's
don't
like,
we?
It's like the people, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So this discovery, it's amazing to know how far back this bond goes. Is it 31,700 years ago in Belgium? Is that the latest find of dog remains showing their connection to humans?
That seems to be the latest. There's a paper out now about what the people are calling a proto-dog or a kind of pre-dog that dates to about 33,000 years ago. You're in the 30,000 plus range for sure for animals that are discernibly different from wolves, but maybe not quite dogs. I call them dog wolves for dog-like wolves. I think that's an appropriate name for them.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about the sociable. I find this really interesting that not all humans are sociable and not all dogs are sociable, but the sociable dogs and the sociable humans kind of got together.
Yes, I think the traditional view, well, what's the accepted view these days is that dogs somehow self-domesticated, which is as bad an attitude as the one that says that humans domesticated the wolf. In each case, you forget half the equation. And in fact, it was humans and wolves who got together. How they did, I think, had to do with the degree of sociability of certain animals, both within human society and within wolf society. So you have a whole spectrum of behavior, you know, from the animal that's very gregarious and wants to go up and meet everyone to the one that's afraid of its own shadow. And it's these highly sociable animals who got together. And it doesn't take long for a wolf to leave wolf society, as it were. It doesn't mean they became dogs right away, but it means that you have a population, a growing population of animals that are sociable to humans, and humans tolerate them. So that you have this kind of union, and they can exist that way for quite some time.
When you say that the dog was an evolutionary inevitability, why?
Well, I say that because of the way that wolf society is kind of parallel to human society. The wolf pack is basically ma and pa. That's the breeding pair, the juveniles who are getting ready to disperse, and the pups of the year. And the pack exists to take care of those pups and each other. They're cooperative, and they defer to each other to get things done. It's not to say that there aren't the parents aren't in charge, because there has to be an adult in the room, I always say. But it does mean that it's a society based on cooperation and not on conflict. Human hunting gathering groups were similar. They were family units that traveled together and cooperated to get food and to survive. So you have these two similar social structures, although the species are different, and they just merge together. And I think when you look at it, even today, when wolves have been persecuted for thousands of years, you have situations where they're coming back. Even in Wisconsin, I think I've read.
Yes.
And they're living close by to people. In Germany, the same thing is happening.
Hmm.
And Germany's a densely settled country, but there were just reports of these wolves moving back and living quite happily. A wildlife biologist told me years ago that wildlife will do quite well around people if you just don't hunt it.
Hmm.
So that won't make me very popular in Wisconsin, probably. But.
Yeah, well, we'll hear from people. That's all right. So the wolves, who were not, though, very sociable, and those that were hung around the humans, they helped each other out, which we'll talk about. And then they changed those wolves that stayed around humans became dogs, and those wolves that didn't like humans very much stayed wolves?
Well, I think I call the dog the wolf who stayed. And I think what happened was that there have been studies done of dingo packs, for example, that show that if you shoot the breeding pair, you destroy dingo society. The youngsters don't know how to behave. I mean, much of learning how to be a wolf or learning how to be a human is educational, right? It's not something you're born with.
Mm-hmm.
And these sociable wolves, as I call them, might breed in or around human camps, human society, and they would eventually, I think, you would get a population of more sociable wolves than less sociable ones, and that the ones who liked people would stay around. And it's clear that one of the chief differences between dogs and wolves is an extended socialization period for dogs. Up to 14 weeks, during which period they become highly bonded to and sociable to people. With wolves, that socialization period is shut down very quickly, like around 6 weeks, I think.
Hmm.
And so that extension, which is probably based on changes in brain chemistry or structure, although I say that advisedly because we know less about the dog brain than we know about our own, nonetheless, there probably were some changes that allowed for because all dogs seem to have this extended socialization period. So you have these changes that occur. Now, ultimately, it becomes a long, complicated process, but ultimately, from these groups of dog wolves, due to isolation, perhaps with the last ice age or some other event, they would breed more with each other than with wild wolves, and
mm-hmm.
then you would get a kind of mutations that occurred that people would capture. I say capture because they would encourage them to appear more often.
And just a few mutations, you write, had large, large effects, and they account for not only the physical changes, but perhaps the behavioral differences between the dog and the wolf.
I think this will show to be the case. The geneticists call these small mutations with large effects. One is a single mutation in a a gene regulating growth that has to do with smallness in dogs. And one of the first divides, I think, in dogdom was between small dogs and large dogs. Small dogs became very desirable at a certain point, as they are now, not just for companionship, but also as ratters or you know, that mm-hmm. could serve as protection in the house when people were out in remote areas. So you have this smallness is one. There are others that seem to regulate the structure and size of the dog to give you that kind of mastiff type dog with the heavy bones and the thick head. And then those that help with sighthounds, you know, the long, lean look. And there's no question but that the way a dog is built, just the way a person is built, affects the way they approach the world. A mastiff is not going to chase game down in most
right.
cases, but a greyhound is. A greyhound, on the other hand, is not going to necessarily stay and grab a bull by the nose.
Yeah. So how did we go from the wolf? So we got the dog, then we got all the mastiff and the pug and the Wheaton Terrier and the Labs, and how did all those develop?
Well, breeds developed in several ways. Naturally, they're what are called land races. That is a population of animals in a certain area that was isolated from a great deal of influx of other animals would develop certain characteristics that made them unique. And this happens in wild species as well as in the dog. And from those breeds then were created starting around I date it to about the late 18th century, the late 1700s, when people clearly began to try to breed dogs. This had been going on for some time, but it grew with the advent of the scientific revolution. And in the 19th century, you certainly get breed clubs coming on. Hmm. And people really created these breeds. Mm-hmm. And they did it by establishing registries and establishing a description of the dog, a standard for the breed. And it became their way. Sometimes it's said that the people who became scientific breeders were attempting to manipulate nature. They were, in a way, imitating God.
Oh, my. We've talked a bit about the sociability aspect of dogs and wolves. Let's talk more about, you write about the curiosity, too, that we're both curious creatures. And then this whole area of staying together because of what you can do for me, what the dog can do for the human, what the human can do for the dog.
Yes, I should preface this by saying that one way we can change our way of looking at the dog and its arrival on Earth, as it were, is because of the past decade or so when animal rights and people who believe in animals have done scientific work showing that animals, in fact, have consciousness and sometimes volition, so that you have animals who know what they're doing. So you have wolves meeting humans, and the two species, if they're going to stay together, then it's a fair question to say, what's in it for me?
Right.
A dog, what's in it for me? You know, am I just going to get beat on by this guy, whacked, you know, whatever? And the human, by the same token, will say, what's in it for me to take this wolf, this thing that could hurt me, into my house, and into my village, into my hut?
Yes.
And I think that if we start with the human, there have been suggestions by other people that humans learn to hunt from wolves. Certainly it's the case that the Aborigines seem to have used dingoes to hunt. They would go out and follow dingo tracks as the animals were on the trail of their prey, and then they would steal the prey, make the kill, steal the prey, and take it back to their camp, maybe leaving some for the dingo and maybe not. So it's possible that humans could learn to hunt by watching wolves. It's also possible that wolves could have taken up with humans because they realized that these naked bipeds, as I called them, furless bipeds, had spears and fire, and they were pretty lethal killers. They could also stampede game off of bluffs or some other cliff and kill a lot more than they needed. So they were kind of profligate at times. And this would, it's a lot easier to let somebody else kill your food than it is to do it yourself.
Sure.
Now, so there's that. And the wolf also, the wolf living near a camp also provides an early warning system by barking or growling or whatever. And this is of great advantage to people, not only to keep wildlife out that might steal their food, but to warn of human intruders.
Mm-hmm.
The wolf or dog wolf also could carry its own weight, could carry a pack, and that greatly extends your reach if you're a human on the move, because you have something else to help you carry the load. So all of these things played a role, and then there's simple companionship. The wolf is sometimes a little more difficult, but I think if we think of it as being freed from the burden of raising those puppies for a year or two, because humans certainly will play a role in it if there's a puppy around, and the camp itself provides protection that the wolves would have had to provide if they were on their own. So it frees them in a way to go walk about or wandering with the humans. It frees them from that social and cultural obligation. And I think that has to be taken into account. And that seems to be a major one. There also, it's possible, I think, and there's some research to indicate this, that despite some notions to the contrary, wolves living near humans may well have eaten better on certain occasions than their
mm-hmm.
wild kin.
Mm.
And this certainly has to be taken into account.
Mm. And then make the jump so we have a better understanding of what happened many, many years ago. How were we, why did we select the dog to move into our beds? You know, to move into our homes so that we're not hunting anymore. We're just really good friends.
Well, you know, I think in some societies this probably happened from the beginning. There's an old Indian or conversation that I was reading the other day, Mi'kmaq Indians in Canada, who had dogs they used for hunting moose. And these dogs were having a conversation, and one of them said, "Oh, you're so well-treated, and you're fed well, and your master clearly loves you, and you get all these things. So you hunt very well for him, and I won't hunt for my master. He doesn't feed me well. He doesn't treat me well." And I think that this, although we tend to forget it, I think that it's the case always that people who succeed with animals are those who treat them with respect
mm.
and kindness, which is not to say without discipline, but with respect and kindness. And when you start looking at that, then you see that that the relationship has always had this depth to it.
Hmm.
And probably there are always people who took animals into their bed. For one thing, they keep you warm on.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And but as to bringing them into the house and dressing them up, and all this,
yeah,
that's a function of our own movement into the city. Hmm. And the curious thing about the wolf becoming dog is that this animal, more than any other, has followed us every step of the way in our own cultural and social evolution. So that we might have met at the trailhead, but now we're partners at the tailgate, as it were.
Oh, an interesting way to look at it. You've followed me every step of the way, and I've done the same. The author of How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends, Mark Durr, is our guest this hour, and we're going to go to your phone calls and emails as well. We have several of both. So if you want to join the conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks to the author, too. In fiction, dogs are used an awful lot as a kind of foil for insights into the human psyche. And the reason I bring that up is there is a book which was read on Wisconsin Public Radio some time ago, Pete Nelson's I Thought You Were Dead, which is about a man with a troubled relationship with his dying father and girlfriend problems. But near the three quarters through the book, he makes an assertion. I think he's trying to teach his girlfriend about dogs, or she's trying to teach him. Basically, that says dogs affiliated with human beings because of the leftover food, the boneyards, and stuff like that. But then the assertion is, if a master dies in an enclosed space with a dog, the dog will not eat the deceased master's body, whereas a cat will. And this
whoa!
This has led to a lot of cocktail conversations, even though I don't indulge in cocktails anymore. And I do want the author to have successful sales, so I'm not trying to tempt him into taking a partisan view here of cats versus dogs. I have had both, and I like both. But is there any truth to these, what I would label myths about the loyalty of dogs to their masters? Because that's one of the things that we do to really anthropomorphize the animals. Mm. And oh, by the way, I don't ever dress my dogs up.
Okay. I once put booties on my dogs. We were living in Vermont, and their feet got cold. I could say something which would be this, that I dare say the humans would eat the master if it came down to that, and they've been known to. I don't think one could say that a dog starving would be any less inclined to take what food was available, however reluctantly or willingly, than any other creature. I mean, you're talking about survival. Beyond that, your question is about the great loyalty of the dog. And yes, I mean, you hear it all the time. I was at a reading the other night, and people were talking about the great love their dog has for them, and it will do anything for them. I think this is a myth. I suggested that people who have dogs who will do anything for them are people who actually treat their dogs well. It might be that some people can beat dogs or other animals into subservience and into slavish devotion, but I haven't heard of it too often. Have you?
Hmm.
I think. Well, we just had.
He's gone.
Oh, but I do think in general that what does occur between dogs and people is a deep empathic understanding, I call it. There are studies done of people who hear a dog's bark. Even if they don't have dogs, they understand somehow what those barks mean, because the dog has developed barking into a highly effective form of communication, sometimes obnoxious. And dogs certainly study us and know what our moods are and how we are affected by external circumstances. And I think that there's something that has to do with that. We just understand each other at a real fundamental level. And that often gets translated by people into saying, my dog loves me unconditionally.
Mm-hmm. You start one of their lovely quotes in the book, but starting with the first chapter, and I wanted you to say more about this. This is an Aboriginal saying, the dog is what we could be if we were not what we are.
Right. I think that's a great saying. I think actually you hear many people a lot of times saying, I prefer my dog, or I prefer dogs to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in terms of this loyalty and this ability to work and this desire to please is what they're talking about. But it's also the skill that the animal has in surviving and hunting, especially in harsh climates. So I think there's that aspect to it. I suspect with the Aborigine, things cut all ways, and there were some negative aspects of the dingo they were talking about, too. But in general, you know people, as we all know people, who say, give me a dog, forget the people.
I say, give me a good dog and give me a good person, too, or several.
Well, that helps.
Yeah, it does. Rich, thanks so much for the call. Benita in Green Bay. Hi, Benita.
Hi. I wanted to mention this program that was on TV where these Russians wanted fox for furs, but they wanted tame foxes that wouldn't try to bite them. So they mated tame foxes to other tame foxes, and they ended up with foxes with floppy ears and spots, and these foxes basically turned into little dogs.
Right.
And another thing I wanted to mention, too, that if you want to point out something to a dog, point at it, the dog will look at where you're pointing. Any other animal will look at your finger instead of where your finger is pointing. But the dog knows enough about human, about how to communicate with humans to look where you want the dog to look.
Mark.
Well, this fox experiment is an interesting one, and I spend time trying to dissect it. They did end up with tame foxes, but I don't think it says a whole lot about dogs. There are numerous problems with that experiment, not least that these mottled coats and floppy ears and other changes seem to occur in populations. Even in the randomly breeding population there on the Siberian fox farm, not at the same frequency that those are selected for tameness, but noticeably, there are other foxes that seem to develop that kind of coat naturally. So that might indicate to someone that there are other mechanisms at work other than selection for tameness. The fox experiment is used to say that the wolf was self-domesticating, that basically they began scavenging in garbage dumps, and that those who were tamest bred with each other, and somehow these scavenging wolves were taken into human society. It's always seemed problematic to me because most humans, we have a lot of scavengers who live around us, and we don't take them into our bed. And so I think that it is a, plus it's a view that cuts the human out of the equation altogether. Mm-hmm. And third, it requires that humans be moving into semi-permanent villages at the time of the transformation of wolf to dog. And the earlier dates we were talking about at the beginning of the show would indicate that the dog, the wolf, and humans, and then the dog got together when people were hunting and gathering and on the move. So I like to say that the dog was actually born on the move.
That's a nice phrase, born on the move. Here's an email from Kay in Spring Green. Would like you, Mark, to please explain how a Chinese pug was once a wolf.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Because, for one thing, there is a condition, the brachycephaly, that causes that punched-in face is a genetic mutation. There also have been studies recently that show that the skull of the dog is manipulable in multiple ways through breeding. So the short answer is that it's done by human breeders, and they do it by capturing mutations, and they do it by inbreeding like crazy to make sure those stay fixed in the population of pugs. So you probably will find, I don't know the exact number, but you'll probably find that the pug is descended from a handful of dogs.
Hmm. You write, the dog is the wolf who decided to make human society its habitat and put its fate in human hands, which is a big thing to do. But which of many subspecies of the gray wolf gave rise to the dog is a question that has long prompted speculation without resolution. Are we any closer to resolution of that?
I think that depends on which group you talk to.
Mm.
There's one group of geneticists centered at UCLA that has done an extensive survey of dogs and wolves that shows that probably the little Arabian wolf or some animal similar to that, because we're talking about animals that lived, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, some animal similar to that was the primary contributor to the dog, with heavy influence from the European gray wolf and the Chinese wolf. And in fact, some breeds may be more directly descended from the Chinese wolf. So it was a mixing and matching. There's another group that says absolutely the dog originated south of the Yangtze River after 16,000 years ago. And they don't have a wolf, actually, to say what wolf it it descended from. Presumably it's the Chinese wolf again. So these two groups have been presenting evidence that contradicts the other for some years now, and I'm not sure there's a resolution in sight. I think that one way the issue could be resolved is to say that dogs appeared south of the Yangtze River after 16,000 years ago, and from there radiated once again to much of the world. But I think you can do that without having them actually originate there.
Hmm. So they came. What about the earliest records on the North American continent?
Well, there again, we get this is one of the interesting aspects of doing this work. Every time there is a date proposed, it seems that another date comes along and pushes it further back in time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it used to be that that people came to the Americas around, 12,000 years ago or so, 14,000 years ago. Now it's been pushed by some groups to 16,000 or longer. I think it's pretty clear that the dog came to North America with the first humans to come into the continents, and the dog was here ever since. For a long time, the dog was really the only domesticated animal in the New World, followed by turkeys and some of the South American ungulates, but the dog was pretty much it.
Hmm. Thanks very much for your email and for the call here. Let's go to Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hello, good morning. The Ojibwe people in the northern Great Lakes region have what I believe to be a legend in which humans and wolves are quite intimately tied. The first human on Earth was very lonely, and so the Creator brought a wolf to keep the human company, and they traveled all over the world together with the understanding that when they came back home, they would separate, they would part ways, but pretty much what would happen to one would happen to the other. And if you look at the history of wolves in American Indian people in the United States, they've been hunted almost to extinction. They've been vilified, persecuted, rounded up. It's a rather compelling argument. And on another subject, the Chauvet Caves in southern France that were discovered in the 1990s, 30,000-year-old cave paintings, there are footprints of a child and a wolf together in the caves that have lingered there for these many tens of thousands of years. I don't know, Kathleen, if you've seen the movie Cave of Forgotten Dreams. It's a Werner Herzog movie. It's just out on DVD.
Oh, okay.
It's fabulous.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, it's 3D.
And just on a really other brief note for Christmas presents, if you have kids, The First Dog, fabulous book by Jan Brett, B-R-E-T-T. The illustrations alone are just fantastic. A lot of pictographs and petroglyphs and ancient art in the borders around the main story, which is about a young boy who has a wolf that's following him around, keeping him out of trouble.
Oh.
Great little book.
Oh. Just maybe no puppy for Christmas, though, right?
I'm sorry?
No puppy for Christmas?
No puppies for Christmas. No puppies for Christmas.
Okay. Thank you so much. You're a wealth of information, Marty. Thank you. Mark?
Well, that's exactly the point, that wolves and humans were born on the move, and they like to travel. I think this can't be discounted. It's true. Wolves have been persecuted in North America. It's also the case that for a long time, well into the 19th century, in some parts among Plains Indians, their dogs would interbreed pretty freely with wolves, and in fact, you sometimes couldn't tell the difference between the two. I might point out that the Native American dogs have been extirpated as well because they weren't liked and they were shot and killed. But those are good points. All that, you know, it's wolves and humans have been together a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
I use wolves there to include dogs. But
are you familiar with this Cave of Forgotten Dreams she talked about?
I actually begin the chapter of my book with Chauvet Cave and that footprint because of the mystery that it raises as to whether it was a dog or a dog wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an unresolved mystery, But it's an interesting notion that these that wolves and it reinforces the those discoveries of skulls dating to 30-some thousand years ago, because it puts dogs or dog wolves basically all over Europe and much of Asia at a very distant past.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. This hour, we're speaking with the author of How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends. Mark Durer is our guest. You may have been a reader of some of his other books. He's written five of them, including A Dog's History of America and Dog's Best Friend. His articles have appeared in many publications, the New York Times, LA Times, Audubon, Sierra Natural History, Smithsonian, Scientific American, and The Atlantic Monthly. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Mary in Eau Claire. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm just wondering, this is a speculation here, but whether there's any link between the glaciation and the ice ages and dogs and humans linking up. I'm just thinking how the Inuit are so close to their huskies, and my dad always said they had three dog nights when the three dogs would keep them warm. So, as I said, it's speculation, but I wonder if a cold climate would make warm-blooded creatures come together.
Mm.
I think what happened during the Ice Ages is that these populations of dog wolves or highly sociable wolves would have been shut into smaller spaces, as it were, along with people, and probably began to get the transformation, the clear physical transformation into dog. So that by the time the ice began to retreat, you had what are identifiable dogs spreading over much of the world. There's this whole question of whether during the Ice Ages there were refuges to which animals traveled and hid out, or whether those refuges were in fact just pockets of unchanged weather where animals that had lived there continued to live there much as they had. I think it's true that there probably were sociable wolves on the steppes, on the mammoth steppes during much of the Ice Age. They're cold adapted the way people were, and certainly they were found through much of the world even by that time.
Thank you, Mary, for the call. Joel in La Crosse. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Mark. I was wondering if anybody's told you, you sound like Burl Ives.
Yes, he does a little bit. You're right.
I take that as a compliment.
Yes, by all means.
My question is, I have Parkinson's disease, and I have two dogs. One is a lap dog, and the other is a Newfoundland, a big dog that help me. They don't have special training, but I'm wondering if there's history where dogs have medicinal properties that endeared them, like mine do.
Oh, you write about the big dog, small dog, don't you, Mark?
Yes, I do. And yeah. I might add, Joel, I have Parkinson's disease.
Do also. You really? Oh, my.
I do. I have to keep my hands away from the table. You hear this?
Oh,
yeah, I do too. I find that I can my Newfoundland. I can borrow her momentum. It's hard to describe, but when I'm going downstairs, I can put my hand on her and actually use her sense of movement to get me up and downstairs.
Well, that's spectacular. That's very good. There are people, you know, who have been training Parkinson's dogs, big dogs, to try and help exactly with the balance issue that you're talking about. I've had this I'm glad you have a Newfoundland that works out. I've had this conversation with people who train service dogs, and we haven't been able yet to determine what would be a good big dog to use. Because if you're a tall person, as you seem to be, then you need a big dog.
I do. And she's very gentle. The drool is the one thing that...
I drool, too.
Yeah, so do I. we're a trio, then. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Did your dog help you, too, before your dog passed away?
My dog was a 35-pound Kelpie, and then I had a 50-pound Kelpie. I didn't really need them for that. I think about... Joel raised the point, though. I'm, you know, now that I'm without a dog for the first time in my life, I think it's time to think about adopting. And I often debate whether to go with a pocket rocket, as I call them, a small dog, or a large dog. And a small dog has certain advantages for picking things up and fetching them. The large dog has certain advantages for balance, and with people with Parkinson's, balance is a major issue.
Right.
So I think we'll go with the pocket rocket first, because I'm not so bad that I need, you know, the dog for balance. But these are issues, and one of the things that is so important about dogs and people is that dogs do help us, and have helped us throughout time, not just to hunt, but also to provide balance, to provide eyes when we need eyes, or ears when we need ears, to protect us. And these are things that can't really be underestimated. You know, you read on the frontier, one of my favorite stories is about a woman who was out picking beans, and her little dog started yapping insanely, and she was getting annoyed at it, until she looked up and saw a big panther was eyeing her two-year-old child. She scooped the child up and ran indoors to wait for her husband to come home. When he did, he couldn't find the little dog. So he took their big hunting dog, yard dog, out, and they killed the panther. And according to the story, they found the little dog's remains in the panther's stomach. It had died defending its people and child. And these stories occur all the time, and they're not myth and they're not legend. They're very real. You know, the paper is filled every day. Papers around the world are filled with the heroics of dogs.
Right. Oh, I love those stories. I love those stories. And the loyalty stories, they just touch your heart. Joel, thank you very much for your call. John in Lake Tomahawk. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
A line that I like. I wish I was the kind of person that my dog thought I was. And also, the guy wrote in a local paper here that dogs do not have expressions on their faces, and I disagree, because when I see one that's sad or hurt or happy, you can tell right away.
I would agree with you completely.
Yeah.
Dogs are pretty telegraphic in terms of how they feel. They also look guilty very well, don't you think?
Yes, they do. They have a real good guilty look. Except the dog I have now. My dog doesn't have that expression. He doesn't feel guilty about a darn thing, Mark. It's part of the problem.
He probably steals the food and then looks at you and says, so what?
I know. It's a so what kind of look.
Do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, the amazing thing about dogs is actually even when they annoy us completely, they somehow, there's something endearing about it in retrospect. Now, I don't say that all the time. Certainly dogs that bite or dogs that are destructive are problematic. But the dog who manages to open the oven and steal the quiche, you get annoyed. But you have to admire the talent that it takes to
exactly
do that.
Exactly. And here's a loyalty story from Connie. This sounds like something out of the movies, but it's true. My grandmother, who passed away some years ago in her 90s, tells of losing her father in 1920 when she was 10. Her parents were German immigrant farmers living in the vast expanses of Nebraska's early farmlands. In the dead of winter, he died of a ruptured appendix. They traveled by wagon 8 miles in the snow to the nearest cemetery to bury him. He had a dog, Captain, who followed him everywhere, who subsequently disappeared. They didn't know for months what happened to him. Later in the spring, the cemetery owner told them that Captain came to lie on the grave and refused all offers of food, water, or shelter. He died guarding the grave, love, and loyalty.
Yeah, those stories are pretty common, and it's pretty remarkable. I did know of someone who actually was in recent years had died as a result of an accident with a drill. He was out working his property, and his two Catahoula leopard dogs stayed by him until the body was found.
Oh, my. Hmm. So you've been, tell me what it is about some people. There are some people who really don't, and we all know them, who really don't like dogs at all. What happened?
That people don't like dogs?
Uh-huh.
Well, I, when someone tells me everyone loves dogs, I say, no, they don't. I think it's part of this sociability issue. There are people there are fear periods for people as well as there are for animals. And if those aren't overcome, they can become problematic. Part of it's a self-protect mechanism, you know, but the other thing is this fear of strangers or strange things. And I think that that's part of it. I think culturally there's bias built into some cultures toward dogs, with good reason in some cases. You know, when the dogs have been used to brutalize people.
Yes,
even at Abu
right.
Ghraib, they were mm-hmm. used to brutalize people. And this is certainly not going to endear that animal to you. And if it gets locked in the culture, then it's going to become a cultural bias.
Mm.
So there are those things. And there are some people who just didn't have dogs when they were young, or they had a bad experience with dogs, and so they don't want anything to do with them. They're afraid of them. Now, dogs, must be said, have an uncanny ability to walk into a room, you know, if it's in their house especially, and they can pick out that one person who really doesn't
yes.
like them.
Yes, they sure can.
And a lot of times they will manage to endear themselves to that person. So dislike is sometimes built on ignorance, often built on ignorance more than on fact.
Hmm. John, thanks very much for your call. Guy on the road. Hi, Guy.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Great. I kind of picked up the program here in the middle of it, but I want to make a couple of comments about a dog. We got three dogs. We got an old farm, and we picked up three dogs. Just people didn't want them anymore, so I think we look like the place that need more dogs. But we got three of them. We got a border collie that we picked up not too long ago. My wife bought from I believe an Amish family. My wife was coming home from picking the dog up and came up over the hill, and you could see our farm, the back property, pretty good from this little hill. Well, our horses and cows were out in the back piece of property. My wife opened the door up to let the dog out. That dog shot away. My wife thought, oh, my God, we lost the dog already. Within probably 3 minutes, she had the horses and the cows running full sprint up to the front pasture and had them corralled by the barn.
Went to work right away, huh?
The dog's never seen the property. She just instinctively saw the animals and figured, well, they got to be up here, not down there. But that border collie has facial expressions. If you try to scold her, she's got the smile that comes on her face. And then you end up petting her and laughing about whatever she did wrong. And if somebody is feeling down in the household or something, she always, always comes up and puts her head on your lap and looks at you. I don't know. The other two dogs are great dogs, but this one here, this border collie, is just one of the most intelligent dogs I ever met in my life. And just almost human.
Hmm.
Almost human. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Mark.
I think that there are dogs that are exceptional that many of us have been lucky enough to have, you know, of all the dogs we've had, and they stand out, and when they do, they stand as kind of the best and finest of what
mm-hmm.
this relationship can be. I mean, it's like all relationships, the one between dogs and people is not always love and peace and happiness, but when it does work and work well, and when you have a special bond with a special animal, it's something unforgettable and something to be celebrated, and it sets the standard for everything else, if you follow me.
Yes.
It just is the best that can happen.
Yes.
And it's sometimes hard when you lose that dog, especially hard when you lose that dog. It's not that you don't love your other dogs any less than you did. It's just that that dog begins to embody and encompass everything.
Mm-hmm. What the best of it, that something can be. Oh, Mark, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope that that new dog comes into your life, the Pocket Rocket makes you happy.
Well, thank you. It's
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Mark Durer, our guest. You spell his last name D-E-R-R, and his book is How the Dog Became the Dog, From Wolves to Our Best Friends. Thanks to Chrissy Pease, fellow dog glover, for producing this show. She knew that I'd say yes. How could I say no? Of course. Look what I found. We love dogs, you know. I'm not going to apologize for it. It's all right. It's a good thing in life. So thanks to Chrissy for on-air production as well. And Rhonda loves dogs, too. She has a cat who is like a dog. So that's it for me for a little while. I'm gonna cut out of the place and go read some novels, maybe, and play with a family and play with a dog. So I'll be with you in 2012. Thanks for listening. Happy holidays. Happy New Year.